Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Andrew Colin. Andrew is professor of political science at Hilbert College. His books include State Power and Democracy, State Structure and Genocide. We've had many stimulating discussions with Andrew on this program, and I'm certain we're going to have another one today. Andrew, I will just mention a couple of things that have been focused my attention on lately. So many. I've got a couple of new articles coming out tomorrow. I put two out today, one on the ongoing peace talks in the Middle East, John Kerry's peace plan. My title of my article today, it's on my blog site. It's called Kerry's Peace Plan, Worthless. Well, that's what it is. It's a lot worse than worthless. Well, I use the word worthless because I'm quoting a Palestinian official. It's a lot worse than worthless. Totally one-sided. I have a second article called U.S. Universities of Shame. I don't think yours is on the list, Andrew. Mine sure is. And it's part two because I wrote about it before. It's about the American Studies Association boycotting Israeli institutions of higher learning. Well, they have very good reason to do it. I explained a little bit in my first article. I went into much greater detail in this new one that I put out today. If you want to know about the educational system in Israel, then read my article. And I wonder if most of the ASA members who voted for the boycott knows as much about it as I try to explain in my article. Literally, from kindergarten, preschool, if there is such a thing in Israel, but from the earliest part of education in Israel, when children are too young to understand virtually anything, they begin getting brainwashed to accept Israeli militarism. It goes all the way up through grammar school, high school, higher education. It gets drummed into their minds, indoctrinated. You know, wars are good. Israel is surrounded by enemies. It needs to go after bad Arabs, using all kinds of pejoratives to describe them. If there ever was a country practicing racist hate, it sure is Israel, and they do it in their own language. It's very easy to quote what they say. It's very easy to come up with your own conclusions. It's not rocket science. Horrific, the names, the language they use to describe Arabs that never harmed Jews when they lived peacefully together long before the British decided they wanted a Jewish homeland in Palestine and Lord Balfour decided he would give so much land to Jews, began slowly. It built. My goodness, I've written so much about it. Anyway, it begins. You have to teach people to hate. You're not born with it. And that's what the Israeli educational system is all about. It teaches hate, it teaches war, it teaches militarism, it teaches it, again, from kindergarten on up. It's all in my article. Oh, so much more, Andrew. Let me let you jump in. I know there's a lot on your mind.
Oh, yes. Well, thanks again for having me back on your program, and I certainly want to get into what you mentioned about Israel, which will take us to certainly aspects of U.S. Domestic and foreign policies. But in connection to that, given that this is the beginning of a new year, I thought it is appropriate and of interest to your listeners to kind of look back for just a little bit in what took place the past year in U.S. Domestic and foreign policy. And then, of course, move forward to what we can expect in the year 2014. But in large part, even what your comments point to about what is the supposed peace talks in Israel is many ways still is, I have discussed with you on many times of your many times I was on your program, the cumulative effects of this post 9/11 era, this terrorism, this manufactured terrorism. And what we see in both, and certainly in 2013, in terms of how the U.S. government has responded to 9/11, what we have is, and I dare call it, a new normal. And what we will still see to some extent, we did see it in 2013 spilling over in 2014, is a kind of what I would characterize as a politics unfolding without historical precedent. Now, what I mean by that is now, if you step back, not just to 2013, but going back to the two Bush and now second Obama administrations, what do we have in U.S. foreign policy, politics, is again a response to 9/11. And much of what the U.S. does, and to kind of get a frame of U.S. politics in 2013 and now this year, is, as I have discussed on more than one occasion, is this government acts as if it has no limits, that somehow this 9/11 business, this, and this is not to downplay the attacks, obviously, but it has given these administrations to act in what I characterize as a state of emergency. And if you look around the globe, not just the United States, and I certainly would characterize the behavior of Israel towards the Palestinians, what you have is essentially police state activities, because police states do act in relation to declared states of emergency. And the United States politics in 2013, in many ways, is this kind of extreme politics justified by an emergency, by this terrorism business. But again, you have to just briefly step back, which I want to just very briefly, and then again move us forward to 2013, 2014. This whole business really dates back to the anti-communist hysteria of the 1940s. Only now, if you then move forward to post 9/11, it is terrorism. But if you look back to the 40s, what was it? We have this national security state created under the Truman administration. And from that, with the CIA, the NSC, FBI, et cetera, and this is what I have discussed on more than one occasion on your program, is what I call a state within a state. And that's what a police state is. It's a specialized set of agencies that answer to the executive branch, whereas, I'm sure your listeners are well aware, power has been incredibly concentrated, and that especially in the area of foreign policy, the president's policymaking reigns supreme. Now, if you fast forward from these early developments in the 1940s, go to the 1960s, and I am not the only person to call this a national security state, what we have is essentially what has now been spilling over into 2013 and now this year, is overall the politics domestically and a foreign policy level is to eliminate dissent. And I want to get to that a little later, what that implications that has. But you certainly had a taste of that if you look at the whole Watergate business and you look at the FBI's COINTEL program. They simply wanted to get rid of political diversity. Now let's move forward to 9/11. And what do we have under this business of terrorism with Patriot Act, Guantanamo Bay, CIA black sites, these aggressive wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, etc., these permanent global wars, I call it. We have a foreign policy which is very militaristic, in which we go to places not so much to stamp out terrorism, but to put down nationalist movements. And we do this, of course, recently using technology with drones. And now we've gone even a step further during the Obama administration with the unprecedented, and again I repeat, unprecedented assassination of U.S. citizens. Now, the point of this very quick snapshot of past events is to take a look at what the implications are as we try to get a summary of what U.S. politics were in 2013 and now in 2014. Get a sense of where, certainly in 2014, where we might be going on both domestic and foreign policy fronts. And I certainly want to, given this is a new year, seem to paint a picture of past events and even in 2013 that at first seemed dire, but offer some what I call cautious optimism. And this is what I want to talk about, is what may be the basis of politics in the United States in 2014. Now, if you look at this national security state, what I have called a police state, and all the things that it's done, I would dare suggest that if you start to look at 2014 and what is perhaps beginning to unfold, is perhaps what I would call, and certainly these foreign policy adventures and drones and endless wars, is pretty characteristic of what many an empire has done in the past, whether we can rattle off all these different empires and the events, but they tend to do what I call seek a last gasp reassertion of control as things are slipping away. And this is kind of typical. I see this in what U.S. foreign policy is. Now, let's look at some of the particulars of that in terms of why I would say such a thing. Certainly, U.S. economically is no longer the dominant power in the world, but certainly has been able to maintain its military predominance. And this seems to be why the U.S. can kind of try to push other nations around. But even if you look at this supposed military superiority and the sending of troops and dispatching of drones, there is still a response, a global response, which to me is a pushback against this militarism. And that is, and this to me spilled over even into the attacks of 9/11, there is this, what I would call a reservoir of resistance and anti-American sentiments in parts of the world to these military interventions, especially after the U.S. invaded Iraq and now, after that, Afghanistan. There's an unfolding anti-colonial resistance, and we see that wherever now the U.S. is dispatching troops, look at Iraq, look at the aftermath of U.S. military intervention in Afghanistan, and the U.S. has not prevailed. And this is, to me, an indication that that U.S. military power is being challenged and is in decline. Now, this, again, is in spite of the endless number of bases and the large number of troops. Now, certainly what was the, to me, the ground-shaking event that started to make for a challenge to the U.S. military globally, and that is, of course, the loss in Vietnam. This was an enormous shock. But this began to spiral into the U.S. seeking to reassert its dominance, and that even in spite of the superior military technology in Vietnam, these poor peasants who subsisted basically on a bowl of rice was able to defeat the world's number one military superpower. But even fast forward from Vietnam and a defeat of the U.S. in Vietnam to 9/11, what do you see happening there in terms of the 9/11 attacks, which, of course, should not be overlooked? These attacks were carried out by a small group of fanatical believers with little money and no military firepower against the world's number one military superpower. And they were able to inflict, sadly, death and carnage to shatter what I call this myth of U.S. invulnerability. Now, there are other indicators, not just of the challenge and possible decline of U.S. military superiority. Certainly the economic might of the U.S. has been in decline since the 1970s. If you look at it, look at this since the 70s, certainly with the devaluation of the dollar, but not only, just look at Europe and Japan. They've been also overtaking the U.S. They've been challenging the U.S., and this is in spite of, if you look at the 80s and all the various trade agreements, still, nonetheless, the U.S. is no longer now the world's number one economic superpower anymore. Now, what implications could this possibly have as we start to move forward and assess what went on in terms of 2013 and moving forward to 2013 to 2014. We see that in spite of what has been going on and accelerating, we have the flight of capital overseas, and this has created, certainly within the United States, the decline of the manufacturing base, a crumbling infrastructure, a steep decline in wages that is adjusted for inflation. Now, what has the U.S. tried to do to respond to this? In the past few decades, and including the Bush and Obama administration, they've given loans to prop up the banks. They've sent out money to these nations to stabilize third world markets, and has initiated what I call military Keynesianism. This has been pretty much a lot of U.S. foreign policy from the 1980s up until 9/11. But it's not the answer. When you pump large amounts of money and you invest your dollars into the military, what now we are getting, and this is the legacy into 2013 and 2014, and why I feel there is some cause for cautious optimism, is it increases global resistance. Now, what could be the basis for what I call this increase in resistance to U.S. military and economic intervention? Something that I feel has been overlooked, certainly by the corporate media, not on your program, is that the limits on U.S. military, economic, and military intervention is, if you look around the world, what are you seeing now? A very interesting global picture. You see an increasing global shortage of cheap labor, and this has been the basis of this exit of capital from the U.S. for the past three, four decades. Now, also, the reason of that decline is that in many parts of the developing world, increasingly, look at it, it's becoming urbanized, especially China. Now, the rural areas have been the cheap source of cheap labor. So now this creates problems for U.S. capitalism to get a hold of and to exploit this cheap labor for obvious profit maximization. So what I want to again get back to, and what I started to talk about at the start of your program, is that what seems to be the apparent strength of the U.S. economically and certainly above all militarily is masking a number of weaknesses and what I optimistically suggest is also opportunities for change in 2014 and beyond. So that let us not be too overly pessimistic as the U.S. military tries to continually flex its military superiority over other nations. Keep this in mind in 2014 and beyond to continually put two-thirds of federal dollars into military weaponry and to send your troops all over the globe. This comes with enormous social costs inside the United States, and this, I believe, in the long run is going to undermine this military adventurism. Certainly also, I would suggest to your listeners that there are what I call economic global costs of the U.S. trying to maintain its superiority, especially militarily, and that such superiority cannot be maintained. Certainly, need I say, which I'm sure your listeners are well aware of, is the crumbling infrastructure. Certainly, this is an indication of the shift of dollars into these military, you know, adventures, I call them. I suggest that the increasing economic cost, that is, of putting money towards U.S. military power, is in a very slow process of erosion, which will be speeding up well after 2014. Now, I would optimistically say that given the problems of investing large amounts of money into the military, this creates the possibility for the greater emergence of growth of what I suggest politically is badly needed in the United States, and that is economic democracy. And this, to me, is the long-term solution for the economic problems in America, is to start to see, and I do see little indicators, I don't want to overstate this, of parts of the economy which are increasingly non-capitalist. And if you look at it, there are certainly large parts of the economy increasingly are non-capitalist. If you look at, for instance, the non-profit sectors, look at major universities, look at hospitals, these are all non-profits. The point being is that while we have a dominant capitalist economy, growing within it are certain segments which certainly create possibilities to move away from this dominant capitalist economy, to do what I call decommodify the economy, and that is the basis of capitalism. Everything has to be sold. Everything is a thing to be sold in order to maximize profit. Now, what would be needed for this, and again, this is long term, this is well beyond 2014, but I would suggest that there may be indications of this starting to emerge ever slowly. Certainly, if there is a direction of the U.S. economy long term, I would suggest that there is a solution in terms of the creation of what I call a no-growth economy. Certainly, that does not exist yet. That's what these trade agreements are about, is continually global growth of capitalism. But I would dare suggest in the interim, there are other steps that could be taken. For example, that what we're starting to see, again, here and there, not yet a global movement, is pressure towards electoral tactics to defend gains made to prevent the further rollback of the social welfare state. This is gaining momentum, and in spite of the media's failure to cover the Occupy movement, this is a lot of what the activity of the Occupy movement is, to build a grassroots way to pressure state and then the strategy is the federal government to demand more public goods, more education, more health, more jobs. And these piecemeal reforms are not trivial. They could be the basis to build a larger goal of transformation to a new social system. So this is part of my basis for saying on your program that in 2014 we could talk about what I call guarded optimism, and that I ask for your listeners to consider that although many of these policies seem incredibly oppressive, and they certainly are, but consider that over time they are becoming what I call increasingly dysfunctional. They are self-destructive policies, and this is the basis for hope and change. That if you look at early 2014, this self-destructiveness, this endless militarism, this global expansion, does come from these authoritarian institutions, does come from police state practices, does come from spying, obviously. But also consider this, that internally, to me, is certainly at first seems like a shocking development, but a very significant one at the same time, that even within these institutions, such as the NSA, such as the FBI and the CIA, that the resistance is coming from within these institutions. And that, to me, is an indication that there is something dysfunctional about these institutions. And need I give just a few examples to your listeners? Certainly, first and foremost, consider Edward Snowden. The revelations of Edward Snowden, of the massive spying of the NSA, and I find interesting that if you start to follow the coverage in the corporate media, this includes Fox and CNN, which certainly to me was surprising. They were acknowledging that Snowden's leaks had some positive function. So again, what seems so powerful that within the institution, the 20, 30-something generation is rising up, and need I say Bradley Manning as well. But also I do want to suggest that if you look at the year 2013 and now looking at 2014, to me I would like to point that there is a trend that seems clear, which to me again offers hope for my notion of guarded optimism. If you look at, and I want to make mention just a little bit of the polling here, the political elites are clearly at odds with the wants of most Americans. And that to me is reason for hope. If you look at poll after poll without citing all the different polls, you'll find that the majority of Americans favor change. They favor, for instance, again, by large majorities, they favor higher taxes on the rich. They favor lower taxes for the masses. And this, to me, is a recognition among many Americans of the vast gulf in America between the rich and the poor, of economic inequality, which has been widening since the early 70s. Now, in these obviously economic tough times, there is also broad support in many cities and towns to seize control of property. And this, to me, is a very interesting development, in that in various municipalities, we see activists, and even with the support of local politicians, to use what is called eminent domain, that is the seizure of property and of public property for public use. you'll see a move on some municipal governments to try and buy properties to benefit communities, to use these properties to create public housing, hospitals, parks, etc. So through the use of eminent domain, activists and local leaders are pushing to compel, for instance, lenders, that is the banks, to reduce the mortgage debt so occupants can remain in their homes. So again, we see this kind of cumulative, what I would call snowballing, and even in a way, certainly sounds minimal, pushback against the economic implications of a capitalist economy. And certainly, need I say the obvious, that banks have been resistant, and I dare not say where this is going to lead eventually, but nonetheless, there are some what I call lessons to be learned in the early days of 2014 that the American people are coming to me, a very significant realization, although slowly and not yet clearly comprehensively, that capitalism is at odds with democracy. And this is a lesson that Americans are increasingly learning and have learned, in fact, if I dare make the comparison, to other historical moments in U.S. history. One in particular, that is during the Great Depression, when the social welfare state was constructed. It was masses who took to the streets that pushed to do something to regulate unfettered capitalism, to create Social Security, unemployment compensation, etc., and to strengthen labor unions. So just now in closing, for my initial remarks, I do say it's possible to be optimistic in 2014 and beyond, as more Americans do realize that capitalism is not the answer, and that the answer is a more democratic-controlled economy.
Andrew, I certainly hope you're right, and I'm certain everyone listening to this program hopes you're right. I must say, in all honesty, I'm not optimistic the way you are. Maybe at some point in the future, but looking ahead as we sit here on the 5th of January, I honestly see no light whatsoever at the end of the tunnel. I mean, maybe we will get that light at some point. I agree with you wholeheartedly. I think America is losing power and influence. I think the two of them combined, there's more dislike for America. A recent poll I just quoted in an article in 68 countries, voting America the greatest threat to world peace. Is there any doubt of that? I'm surprised that Israel didn't come in second. Israel is listed among the top five or six, but the numbers get very, very low, and only 25% voted America the greatest threat. I mean, I would think it would have been a great majority of people saying that, because it certainly is true with all the wars that America is waging now, direct and indirect ones, and the ones it has waged in the past, literally nonstop wars, especially since 9/11 with multiple wars, and Obama exceeding the worst of George Bush, as I like to say. I mean, doubling down, tripling down the Bush wars. I mean, one after another, again, the indirect ones you never hear anything about, like in Somalia, in Yemen, in other countries, in Pakistan, dare I say, the AFPAC war, which probably most Americans, if you use that term, they wouldn't know what you're talking about. But the war in Afghanistan is a Pakistan war, too, the bordering areas supposedly sheltering Taliban. Well, you can call them anything you want. They're not exactly the kind of people I want ruling my government, but they're freedom fighters. They're the same freedom fighters that fought the Soviets in the 1980s in Afghanistan, and Ronald Reagan welcomed them to the White House and honored them. Mm-hmm. Well, these are the people we're now calling terrorists, and so on and so forth. But again, all this stuff is going on, including a war on freedom at home. And I've written so much about police state America, it's very easy to explain it. All you have to do is document the laws that have been passed. Post 9/11 alone, it's all there in black and white. You can't hide this stuff. The Patriot Act wasn't even the first thing done. That the first thing done was a Bush memorandum that, I don't have the name of it in front of me, but it was, it may have been after the Patriot Act. I'm not certain. They were very close together. and basically it declared war on the Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, or anybody we call an unlawful enemy combatant, literally destroying the result, the rights of these people, you know, guilty by accusation, as I like to put it. We need to take a break with the music playing in the background.
Sure.
But we'll continue this. And I mean, this stuff goes on endlessly, and every country America went to war with, my God, I mean, the raging conflict cauldron of violence that persists, Iraq, Libya, and so on. We'll take a break and come right back.
Sure.
Welcome back, talking with Andrew Cohen. Andrew, let me just give you a little bit more of some of my thinking.
Sure.
I happened to write an article I put out on New Year's Eve that I call 2014 Predictions.
Oh, boy.
And I began it saying, some are best guesses, others are easier to make. For billions worldwide, 2013 was grim, and then my next line, expect 2014 to be no better. For many, it'll be worse. I basically spent most of the article discussing what already has gone on, because I'm suggesting continuity ahead. So after going through all of that detail, I ended with what I call the brief summary. And here it goes. It's not a good prediction in the lot, Andrew. You can rip me to shreds. And I honestly hope everything I said is rubbish and wrong and turns out to be exactly the opposite. But here's what I said. Expect 2014 to include direct and proxy wars continuing without end, new ones beginning, America's wealth increasingly transferred to corporate and privileged interests, ordinary people increasingly on their own, sink or swim, a race to the bottom continuing, America's disadvantage most harmed, poverty, unemployment, underemployment, hunger, and homelessness worse than ever in modern times, bipartisan complicity assuring it, social safety net protections increasingly eliminated, freedom disappearing in plain sight, police state harshness increasing, local police collaborating with federal authorities more than they've ever done up to now, NSA watching everybody more closely, Washington increasingly waging war on ordinary people, full-blown tyranny approaching, America more than ever unfit to live in, 2014 exceeding the worst of Orwell's 1984. Well, that isn't exactly joy to the world, is it, Andrew?
No, but you sure, that's a terrific summary, and I wouldn't take issue with anything you said there. But this is what I do want to suggest, that when you mention those particulars, what also I think could be included is that while this is obviously awful things and certainly gives us great pause for concern, but these kind of policies are going to lead to decline. And I dare not prophesize how that will unfold. But what, again, I want to suggest, which, again, by reiterating, that these conditions cannot be maintained. And that, for instance, having wars, militarism, et cetera, all those other particulars we can identify, I, again, would like to restate that the economic course of an empire cannot be maintained long term. I don't have the figures in front of me, but I recall seeing them quite recently. They're just quite astounding to maintain the bases, the troops, and the economic commitment to this global militarism. And that we are facing the, obviously, as you well know, the economic consequences at home. And this is going to certainly, I would dare predict, and I may be, of course, obviously wrong, is going to lead to resentment, unrest, and rebellion of various kinds. Again, I don't know if it's going to strengthen the authoritarianism. That is certainly a possibility. But it also, on the other hand, can increase movements for social alternatives. That if you look at whether it is the Dutch, the Spanish, the French, the English, how did the Turkish, how did all these empires crumble? They crumbled from within, from the internal contradictions, but basically economic costs that they couldn't maintain their empires, they stretched too thin, and we are really stretched too thin. So again, I say this inability to finance militarism is in the long term, while we're all suffering, obviously, is going to undermine these kind of policies. Now, again, prior to the break, you mentioned a couple of things which I think, again, I think is worth getting back to. I certainly absolutely agree with what you're saying about the Middle East, and that the greatest threat in the Middle East, if you look at the polling there, is not Iran. I repeat, not Iran. But all the polling of Arabs in the Middle East is who's the greatest threat? It's Israel and the United States. That, to me, is a no-brainer. But look at now in the United States, and here again is the contradiction to me, which says that dire as some of these things are obviously are, and they continue to unfold in such way, they could, unravel institutionally. Now, let me just mention one example of this. That's the NSA. And obviously much has been in the news, and we've all been following the NSA and the revelations of Snowden. And obviously the implications are awful, that everything we do is sucked up and stored, and no, let's forget about privacy. But I also say there's something else to consider, and maybe this is something long-term, obviously not short-term, but for the NSA to do what it's doing, to criminalize thought, which obviously it is, and the Orwellian monitoring of us and, you know, thought police, it does say that the NSA, and for that matter the U.S. government, is afraid of us. They're afraid of democracy. They're afraid of diverse thinking. They are afraid of dissent. That's why they have this secrecy. So I am saying that any exposure calls these institutions more into question. And then I have to say something positive, certainly, maybe in the long run, not in the short run.
Go ahead. Andrew?
Yes.
Oh, well, while you pause for a moment, I would just say to you that I absolutely 100% agree. I said it before, I'll say it again, that U.S. policies are literally leading it into decline. And I think it's a reason why some of these things go on, that America is grasping for a way to hold on what it's losing control over. Chalmers Johnson, when he was alive, he used the term overreach or overstretch, where literally America is driving itself into bankruptcy. And unless it completely turns around and comes up with a new set of policy objectives, it's going to go the way of all the previous empires, and there isn't a single one in world history that ever survived, and America is no exception. It's going the same way. It's just hanging on for dear life. It may grab itself a few extra years, maybe a decade or two. Who knows? But it's going down the same road. It's going to have the same fate. I'd love to be around when it happens, Andrew. I'd love to see this thing come apart. I just hope the world doesn't come apart with it when it happens.
That certainly, I have to say, in agreement, that could be a possibility. But again, I agree. But look at the British. I mean, if you want to consider one example of an empire, at least I would say they were wise enough to realize the course of empire, the economic course, and they simply gave it up.
They sure did.
I don't know if America is going to willingly give it up or give it up kicking and screaming, but I would dare predict, and my 2014 optimism is that all empires crumble. And the U.S. is just another empire that sooner or later will crumble. None of them are permanent. And
by the way, in one of his books, I think it was Nemesis, the Chalmers Johnson compared the U.S. empire to Britain and to Rome. And Rome chose the wrong way, although it lasted a few hundred years, and Britain chose the right way. It chose some form of democracy after World War II, and Rome chose the wrong way and perished, and Britain stayed alive because it took the right path. And basically what Johnson was saying is, if America follows the same example as Britain, then America can survive. And if it goes the way of Rome, it's doomed.
Yes, and very interesting that, yes, I read the Chalmers books, most insightful. And if you look at the British, when they gave up the empire, this was the plus side, they got national health care.
Yes.
So there's something to be gained by giving up empire, obviously, and that their healthcare system, I would argue, is certainly in better shape than ours, and they spend a lot less. But that's when, you know, a wise decision is made to give up empire. You can't have, as we say, the slogan is guns and butter, and that's the cost of empire.
Oh, it sure is. It absolutely is. And I agree with what you said, Andrew, and I certainly agree with Chalmers. I was lucky enough to have him on another program I hosted one time, and unfortunately he took ill, and I couldn't get him back on air again, including on this program. He didn't really talk about his health problems, but he just said that he wasn't completely up to par without any explanation. Then only later did I realize that he was very, very gravely ill, and he ended up dying much too soon a few years ago. I think it was in November, and it might have been 2010, 2011. Mm-hmm. I forget mm-hmm. the precise year.
Recent.
But it was
yeah.
a great loss.
Yes. But you see, that literature of Johnson and again and of others, there's a whole, authors we could rattle off, they pretty much make a similar argument that the course of empire eventually become too great, and that it causes such internal contradictions that the empires are in decline. And I see this. I see this overreach and this attempt to reassert, and certainly partly in response to Vietnam, but to other things, as overreach again, and trying to say, see, we're not really losing it, but really it says that we are, that we have to make a concerted effort to say that we're still number one, even militarily.
It's shocking the amount of money America spends on militarism, and it's a lot more than the annual National Defense Authorization Act budgets, $600 billion or so, somewhere in that neighborhood. It's far, far more. I would say at a minimum it's about $1.5 trillion a year. It may even be more than that, because there are multiple black budgets. The Pentagon has them. Other agencies have them. Of course, you've got the spy agencies, NSA, CIA. You've got FBI. America has 16 spy agencies that we know about. Maybe there's a few more that we don't know about that we will one day. But the unbelievable amount of money that is spent on these activities, and you got to throw in Homeland Security, you got to throw in everything related to veterans, you got to throw in the amount of opportunity costs and other losses because of the money spent in one direction that causes so much harm in other directions that, these are losses. Economists Stiglitz has written about Stiglitz and Blimes, wrote about that a few years ago, about the cost of the Iraq war alone, something on the order of $3 trillion, where if you look at the official numbers, it may be in a few hundred billion. I don't know what the official numbers are, but, in the hundreds of billions. And Stiglitz and Blimes did a study maybe more than 3 years ago, maybe 5 years ago, and came up with a number something like $3 trillion with all of the externalities that you got to throw in. And you got Afghanistan, you got all these other wars, and all of these expenses, and the interest on the national debt, and other government agencies that are involved in U.S. militarism, weapons development and so on. I mean, enormous amounts of money, literally an open checkbook, and the so-called sequester of something like $1.2 trillion that are taken out of the budget, supposedly equitably out of all categories. Well, it doesn't touch the military at all, in fact. There are numbers. They play with numbers. But when it comes down to it, the military comes out of it unscathed, and ordinary people get hammered incrementally over a 10-year period, where the social benefits are literally being eroded en route to total elimination, and the war machine gets funded over and over again with unlimited amounts, and the spying machine and the related machines, there's no way you can keep this up in.
Oh, sure, but let me further elaborate, sure, that what you see is that in order to finance this, you have to essentially redistribute monies, which has been happening for now many a decade from the bottom to the top. And this is why we have such an inequitable tax system, that the tax burdens are borne by the middle and working classes. And we see the results starting in the 70s, certainly in the uptake of American militarism in terms of its reassertion. We see the decline of the American middle class, which is on its way out, clearly. But what I see, again, and this is my, theme for your program today, my optimistic, somewhat, silver lining here, is that what you do see is there has been, and again, I could cite any number of examples, when you have extreme inequality, you tend to have mass rebellion. You tend to have unrest and movements that of people who are fighting back. And that's why I can see that just from other examples in other countries. Certainly in the developing world, that's the basis for unrest there, this extreme inequality. And we are certainly at the point of U.S. history where this income inequality is at its most extreme.
Well, it certainly is extreme, and it's getting worse and worse. The great wealth transfer from ordinary people to the super rich, to the corporate interests. You know, the bankers get trillions of dollars. The Pentagon gets trillions of dollars. There was a report done, and I wrote about it a few months ago, that from around 1996 through 2011 or 2012, the Pentagon has something on the order of $8 trillion, with a T like in Tom, $8 trillion they can't really account for.
Sure.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, this is the kind of stuff that goes on for the war machine, for the bankers, for the other corporate interests, and ordinary people get short shrift, and it's getting shorter all the time. And again, this is an untenable system. It's going to come apart at some point. It's like the stock market. You can levitate it so long, and finally you blow the bubble machine up so much, and the higher up it goes, the greater the fall when it finally happens. It's happened before in history. It's going to happen again. We see the same thing repeating, and you could say that about empire. Empire can only go so far. Finally, it reaches a point of no return, and that's the end of the game, and it can be a very violent end. That's what I fear most, Andrew, that when America's empire comes apart, it's going to be a whole lot different than when the previous ones did. They came apart with a whimper compared to America.
True.
I fear America's going to come apart with a real bang.
But we do expect, and there's certainly the indications of decline already.
Yes.
And certainly, I again consider another symptom that the American people have no confidence in corporate America. They do not trust corporate America. There is a clear recognition that the government is serving their interests. And these, to me, are all symptoms of possibly becoming the basis for social change. I don't know what else it would take. I dare not prophesize that. But these, to me, are certainly indicators that have to be watched.
Oh, they sure do. It certainly gives me plenty to write about, Andrew. I'm on this stuff all the time. I wrote an article this morning. I'm not going to get it out tomorrow. I've got a couple of others I want to get out. But I wrote about a century of war, and I focus mainly on America's wars. But America fights wars different ways. It fights hot wars. It fights financial wars. It fights political, social wars. There's an article, a feature article, in the latest January-February issue of Harvard Magazine. It's by a Harvard sociologist. And he writes about the disruption of eviction. You know, when I think of it, I think of homeowners being thrown out of their homes and bankers repossessing them. He focuses on renters, poor people who simply are losing jobs. They don't have enough money to live on. It may come down to a choice between eating or paying the rent, and they simply can't afford it, and they end up missing a rental payment or two, and with minimal days notice, they get an eviction notice, and on eviction day, the sheriff shows up, maybe with some help. You hear a loud knock on the door. If nobody answers, they break in. And they start throwing people's stuff out in the street. If people are at home, they give them a choice. They can either pay to put their stuff in storage, or it'll be put out on the lawn, and they're on their own to take care of it. It doesn't matter whether it's raining, snowing, or anything else. This is what happens. And at most, they might get 6 or 8 days notice. That's a pretty short time for people to figure out a way, where am I going to live? And if they can't, I mean, they just can't move out and move in someplace else, slam bang, just like that. And if they can't do it, they're going to be out on their ear. And a lot of them end up in shelters or on the street. It's a horrific situation, and there's virtually nothing reported about this. An occasional story, but you hear so little. So these are nameless, faceless people suffering in the millions. In the millions. It's not a handful.
Yes, and even worst of all, yes, absolutely. And even worst of all, this is the working poor.
Yes.
These are people who are having to subsist on these atrocious minimum wages, not living wages, but minimum wages. But if you look, there's been increasingly a movement to organize the working poor, especially if you look at what's going on, and it's hardly been successful, but it's certainly, they're working to organize the workers in like Walmart and to raise the minimum wage. So again, these are little indicators, and again, I don't want to overstate what they may lead to, but certainly there is an understanding that there is injustice in American society.
Oh, is there injustice? And I agree with you also that injustice can only go so far, and at some point people cross a threshold of pain where they simply can't take it anymore. And if we're lucky, we can have nonviolent resistance. We've had a lot of that in America. But I remember the 1960s when cities went up in flames. They burnt the wrong parts of them. They burnt the inner cities. They should have burnt the parts of the cities causing all the trouble. But my goodness, I seemed to move from one place to another, and I wasn't living in a city that was burning at the time. But my cities of Pittsburgh and Chicago, I mean, they're horrific things that went on there. And we've got the same kinds of inflammatory conditions that are just making it ripe for other incidents of this kind. Back then, it was a combination, mostly civil rights, but a combination of lack of civil rights with lack of economic and political rights. And we literally have the same thing now, where I've written in articles that all the civil rights gains won in the 1960s are gone, And the skirmish, the Lyndon Johnson waged on poverty in the 1960s, well, poverty is a lot worse now than it ever was when he waged that skirmish. So what's going to happen now? How much can people take? I mean, it's horrific where people literally have to choose. Are you going to eat? Are you going to pay the rent? Are you going to pay medical bills? Kids who are lucky enough to have a hot meal at school, it may be the only one of the day they get. These kids show up at school hungry because their parents haven't got enough money to feed them properly, let alone provide proper nutrition. And this is what's going on in America, affecting millions of people, where the poverty threshold defined by the Census Bureau, about 23,500, is absurd. It's absolutely absurd. I mean, people living on double that amount in Chicago, family of four, they might have a hard time struggling to get by. They might be very close to the line. If they're making 10 or 15,000 less than that, they are below the poverty line. And we need to raise the threshold. Even the Census Department admits it, but it's not really doing it, or it's not doing it enough. And so you get these people suffering horrendously, and it's getting worse, and the inflation numbers are rigged. Real inflation is multiples higher than the official numbers, so people are suffering. I mean, oh my goodness, I mean, everything from transportation to medical expenses to food to rents, interest rates are low, but certainly not on your credit cards. Dare I go on, Andrew, with all these horrors done against ordinary people?
Sure. Your comments also, to me, indicate that these are social segments that feel there is no future.
Yes.
But I also say that when people feel sometimes they have no future and they feel desperate, they have nothing to lose, they're willing to take chances. And if you look at young people, I consider that they are certainly might be a source of change. Look at people who attend college and that they are in this horrendous debt. They're well aware that they're going to be debt-ridden. They have their future may be limited. They may not be able to buy a house. Their standard of living is not going to be that of their parents. And if you look at the Edward Snowdens, the Bradley Mannings, it's of that generation of the 20s and the 30-somethings that are understanding that the system is not serving their interests, and they're willing to take chances and look at, you know, in a way I say poor Bradley Manning, what he's going through, and even Snowden in his own different way, that they're willing to take the risk because they say, well, look, I've got nothing left to lose.
Indeed, they've got nothing else to lose, and I think there are growing numbers, millions of people in America that literally have nothing to lose. And if we've had these disruptions in the past, Andrew, it's not a great leap to look ahead and see that in all likelihood they're going to happen again. It's just a matter of when and how bad. And once it starts, remember Occupy Wall Street. It began in September 2011 in Zuccotti Park, if I'm pronouncing it right, in New York.
Yes.
Zuccotti Park, I guess it is, in New York, near Wall Street. And it literally spread like wildfire across the country. So if you get something going in one city, especially a major one, I mean, it literally can cross the country in no time flat, and we could have a mini-revolution on our hands.
Oh, sure. And it was a youth-based movement and, again, drew some inspiration from the Arab Spring. But, again, one must always consider, and why I have my guarded optimism, the key, and what I always tell my students is, in politics, you have to always have to look for the unforeseen. And I say some of these unforeseen things may offer possibilities for change in American politics, and certainly from the bottom up. I say certainly from young people, and workers are increasingly seeing the need to organize and to fight for their rights, women as well, and these social segments, who knows, may coalesce into a movement for change.
Indeed so. We're just about out of time. I think it's for young people to really take the lead on this because it's their futures that are at stake. Old guys like me, Andrew, are the best of my years are behind me, except for what I'm doing now, which really is the prime of my life because of my writing and media work, and I love it, and this is the way I want to spend my time as long as my health holds out. But I had opportunities when I was young. America wasn't perfect, but it certainly gave this inner-city kid a chance that kids in my status today simply do not have, and if it even exists, the ability to get a decent job, you can't afford to go to college. It was cheap when I went. You could go to the best schools in the country. It was dirt cheap. I didn't have to go into debt to go to school. But the kids today, completely different situation. Andrew, I look forward to getting you back. I think I hear the band striking up in the background.
Yes. I look forward to coming back on your program.
Oh, I look forward to getting you back again. And I certainly hope that the light that you see turns out to be the light that shows up.
Hope so.
Thank you, Andrew. Join us again next week, Fridays, 11 a.m. Eastern Time, weekends at 1 p.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.